This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and I recently decided to give Sterling Soap Company's Ground Breakfast Blend coffee a try. While brewing, the aroma was inviting, and the taste? Lightly sweet and delicious, as the texture of this amazing coffee was sweet and smooth, as I experienced a coffee with a velvety texture, almost creamy. Sterling's breakfast blend is light but in no way weak, with a high quality taste and smell. My wife and I are now hooked on Sterling Soap coffee, and you should be too. Check out their coffees and other products at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Doug Levy kicking off episode number 6 of Under the Radar, Olympic Athletes You Gotta Meet. Shout out to the fine folks at the Sports History Network for hosting this podcast, based in part on my book, Hero Redefined, about unsung heroism by Olympic athletes. Find it and give it a read if you get the chance. Today, we're proudly trekking to the north to hear two Canadian Olympians tell their stories and give their perspectives of the 2026 Winter Games still freshly in our rearview mirrors. Karen and Brian Stemmel came to love skiing and excel at the sport on the hills of Ontario. Then they became alpine skiing Olympians who shoots down scores of slopes throughout the world. And there's one particular daunting mountain that became a centerpiece of Brian's story of courage and perseverance. More about that one later. For now, though, let's bring Brian and Karen into our little podcasting village. Welcome to the show, you guys.
Thanks for having us on, Doug.
Well, let's dive right in, you two, or I guess I should say snowplow right in, you two, to your backgrounds. I think it's safe to say we're talking to two members of Canadian skiing royalty here. Brian, you competed in 4 Olympic Games. Karen, you were in the 1984 Games in Sarajevo. And I think you've got about 20 top 10 World Cup finishes between you. And Brian's in the Canadian Skiing Hall of Fame, and you're both in your hometown Hall of Fame in Aurora, which isn't too shabby. So why don't you, if you don't mind, tell our listeners how it all started and built up for you guys?
Well, it really started with our parents. I'm the older sibling, and our dad took our mom on their first date, and he taught her how to ski. She'd skied a little bit growing up, but he really got, they were, I think, 19 and 21 at the time. So the first date, they went skiing. They just loved it. They knew they wanted to ski. They had no money, so my dad said to my mom, well, we could be ski patrollers. So just north of Toronto at an area called Blue Mountain, they were ski patrollers to start, and then friends of theirs talked them into going over to Georgian Peaks, which is where we still are to this day. So in the early 60s, they were ski instructors at Georgian Peaks. And again, because they didn't have money, they didn't have a babysitter, I came along a couple of years later, and they just started taking me to the hill. And I have a picture of me. I was born in January, so I have a picture of me at 12 months with these homemade skis on. And we just skied every weekend. And, of course, Brian came along almost 3 years later. And just I always say we got good by accident, because we skied every single weekend from pretty much when we could walk.
Yeah,
the
ski hills aren't that big up there. So, they're only about 800 or 900 feet vertical. So they're quite small, but we didn't realize it at the time. Like, I've enjoyed skiing down my grandparents' driveway in my plastic super slider snow skates, they were called, and laced up around your snow boots, and you could just rip down. And I used to hit jumps just in their driveway. So Georgian Peaks at 900 feet vertical, one of the 6, I guess, clubs, ski clubs or ski areas up there that you can ski at, just seemed big at the time.
Yeah, I love that. I love the getting good by accident. Isn't that how it should always be, right? First build up a love and then go from there. I want to have you two talk about the Winter Games we just saw in Milan-Cortina, but Brian, first, if you don't mind, I want you to talk about your harrowing confrontation with Mount Hahnenkamm in 1989, and then your narrow near miss had a gold medal nearly a decade later. I got the honor of profiling you in my book, but for those listening in, can you rewind those two events? Because they're pretty incredible, each on their own, and certainly together.
Yes, well, I was first time racing in Kitzbühel. It's the Super Bowl of ski racing, and the mountain's called the Hahnenkamm, and the hill or the run is called the Strife, and it means the stripe, and it's basically a white ribbon of death that takes you from the top of the Hahnenkamm mountain to the bottom. And it was my first time there in 1989. I'd already been third twice on the World Cup ski tour, which was pretty good for a youngster. And first time at Kitzbühel, I pretty much thought I was going to win. I felt so good. And I ended up getting caught in a net going about 110 kilometers an hour. I was skiing alongside it. My left leg caught the net and ripped my leg backwards. And I had an open fracture of my pelvis. And I was in the hospital for 2.5 weeks in intensive care. They gave me a 50-50 chance of living, but I pulled out of it and spent 2.5 months in the hospital in Toronto. And then decided for some reason a year and a half later to go back ski racing again. And I won my first race back, the Pan American Olympic Game or Pan American Games in 1992 in Las Leñas, Argentina, or 1991, pardon me. And that was a real thrill. So I knew I was back, but I still wanted to win an Olympic medal. And I raced in 92, didn't do well, raced in 94 in Lillehammer, didn't do well. In 1998 in Japan, I had the lead 3/4 of the way down and I missed a gate a little further ways down. So I was in certain medal territory. If I'd won the gold, we'd be writing a different book, I guess, or you'd be writing a different chapter in your book. But it was a time that was very challenging just to get through the injury part, but also challenging afterwards to get through the disappointment of losing an Olympic gold medal. But really, it's about perseverance and giving myself a chance to be there, and I was really close, so I was proud of that. So to make a long story short, that's my ski racing life in a few minutes.
Well, I can't help but I want to come back to this though, because you're a very modest guy, and you're sitting next to your older sister. But I think your older sister shared that coming off of a fall like you had in Hahnenkamm, she probably wouldn't have gone back on the slopes. For our listeners, Brian, you made a decision. You came to a decision about skiing that's pretty amazing. For someone who, had a 50-50 chance, as you said, of living or dying, you made it. You got back to your feet eventually, but you made a decision about skiing. I want you to talk about that process in your mind. You somehow came to a decision a lot of us wouldn't have come to after, a near miss in life, and you decided you were going to get back on all those slopes. So, can you maybe recreate that? Because it's an incredible decision.
Yeah, there was it seemed like an easy decision to me because there was no further risk of injury. So if I had a bad knee injury and my knee was only 70 or 80%, I could have come back and done okay, but my pelvis was completely healed. I have two pins and some wire in there still that holds me together, but it was completely healed and I was totally fine and there was no further risk of injury unless I fell the same way, which wasn't going to happen because since my accident they put plastic on the fence. So you don't get caught anymore. You just slide off the plastic. So that's been an innovation that has helped after my bad accident. But lying in the hospital, I never considered quitting. I never wanted to be defeated by anything, and I'm super competitive. So it was an easy choice for me to go back and do it again. The process was difficult because there was a lot of fear and demons and things I had to get through to get me back to where I wanted to be. And I was second in one race. I raced Kitzbühel again, which was really tough, the hardest thing I'll ever have to do. Actually, before I had kids, I guess. But it was difficult at the time, but it was the only thing that I wanted to do. And somebody asked me recently, how many times throughout your career did you want to quit? And I said, just once. And that's when I did. And that was in 1999 after my career was pretty much finished. I knew I couldn't win anymore. So yeah, I never considered giving up or succumbing to the fear and anxiety that goes along with being a downhill racer and the fear of being injured again. I love that part of it. So I just somehow got through it.
Our mom wasn't thrilled when Brian decided to go back after he almost died because she had a hard time thinking about it anyway, and then knowing that he was back racing and, could get injured again. It was more difficult on our parents, I think, than on us.
Yeah, they went to what next time I raced to, in Kitzbühel, they went to Tahiti. They didn't want any connection,
Star racing again.
nothing. There wasn't internet at that time, but still, they just didn't want any part of it. They wished me good luck.
I love it. I love it. Well, it's a tale of perseverance, and we're going to come back to a U.S. skier I want to ask both of you about. But first, let's reflect a little bit on the Winter Games. From what I understand, a pretty good game, pretty good games for Team Canada. A number of medals, nothing in alpine skiing. But what was Brian? You spent a lot of years in broadcasting. What was your take on the Olympic Games just passed for Canada, and what's the perspective for the country going forward?
They were good for Canada, but not in alpine skiing. Alpine skiing, they were pretty disappointed. They hoped they would have one medal, and they came away with not, maybe one top 10 or two top 10, so not very productive at all. And I know the athletes wanted so much more. They only go there for the medals. So but a lot of them had been injured. It hasn't been a great season for alpine skiing. There have been some changes at the top now, finally. So we're trying to get a grassroots program going again, so there'll be some younger skiers coming up. But the skiers that are there now are really good. They just weren't this year. They had a bunch of different reasons. Injuries was one of them, as always, as an alpine skier. But Jack Crawford was ninth, and that was acceptable. But the others had a chance of winning. Val Grenier and Cameron Alexander had a good chance of being on the podium. They just didn't deliver on, 2 minutes in 4 years. It's pretty hard to be on in that exact moment. So it is a challenge. I've done it four times and didn't come close. So I know how hard it is. But that's the only thing they go there for, the medals. They just didn't perform on the day that they had to.
I was sad for Brian because Brian's been doing the commentating for Canadian television for the alpine ski racing for years since he retired, basically. And I was hoping selfishly for Brian, he'd be able to call a medal, like as a commentator, to be able to say that your teammate has won, but unfortunately, it didn't
Well,
happen.
and there were so many watch parties and things going on because it's early in the morning here, but people are getting up at 6 in the morning having champagne and orange juice and watching the Lindsey Vonn race because they wanted to see it. And then, it didn't turn out as we expected.
Well, let's dig further into that because I think you two have incredibly unique perspectives to offer here, incredibly important perspectives. And in the United States, Lindsey Vonn was quite a story, a decorated downhiller, 41 years old, making a comeback, and there she is in the Olympics. And I think you two are acutely aware of how dangerous downhill skiing can be, the precision it demands, and the speeds you get up to going down that hill, and what it all requires. Well, 13 seconds into her run, it didn't go so well, and she has this dramatic crash and fractures of her tibia and fibula and a broken right ankle, and she's airlifted, and the whole scene unfolds in front of us. In an era of not only TV and social media, so of course it's everywhere. And we had in our country certainly a lot of fans turn computer keyboard experts and, making observations about whether Lindsey Vonn should have gone ahead and done it because she'd injured herself before the games. And, should she have withdrawn and let someone else take the shot at it? And again, Brian, you've been there, and you've dealt with a horrific fall. And Karen, you know what it's like to be a female skier and under all that pressure and the spotlight. So I'm really interested in having you two talk about that whole thing and what you think on the Lindsey Vonn front and what she could have done, should have done, and all of the after.
Well, I think she should have been there. I think she had done well leading up to it. She was leading the World Cup downhill standing. She'd won a couple of races. Yes, she tore her ACL. I think it was 9 days before the games. But as you mentioned earlier, Brian being very humble, and he doesn't like to talk about himself. Brian actually ski raced at his first Olympics, 1988 in Calgary, with a torn ACL. So he has been there, done that, and knows what it's like to ski with us and race with us. Okay, well, he might have fallen. He's finished.
Fell on my side and missed a game.
But it didn't have to do with ACL, did it?
No,
Goodness.
it was my other side.
No, I 100% think she should have been there. She is just such a legend. It's one of those things when you get into the sport, and I was interviewed after I ski raced by a television network that had this talk show, a sports talk show. And the question was to the panel, if you could take some sort of drug or potion or whatever it is, and you're guaranteed an Olympic medal, but you're going to die within 5 years, would you do it? And of course, today I would say no. At the time, I said yes. I actually said yes, I would do it. And now it seems crazy, but your whole life is for your sport, and you give up so many things, and you just do anything for that win and the medal, and you know, we're all very competitive. So I don't blame Lindsay or think it's negative at all. I think she totally should have been there. I really was hoping she was going to win, and unfortunately it didn't turn out, but well, maybe you have a different perspective.
No, same thing. She should have been there. If she wanted to be there and she thought she could do it, of course, like go for it. I'm 100% on board with that. You don't want to leave a sport or leave a race not knowing if you could have done it or not. So you have to give yourself a chance, and she did that. And she was good in training too. She was fine in the two training runs and no problems. The problem on race day, she just wanted it too badly, and she didn't ski just like she needed to. She was just the regular 41-year-old Lindsey Vonn with a partial knee replacement, a torn ACL. She would have been in the medals. It would have been easy for her, but she wanted to win so badly. And then in the turn where she had the issue where she fell, like look in the neighborhood, your neighborhood, and find the steepest roof. And that's the side hill that she was skiing along. So she's going along the side of that steep roof. And her left ACL was torn. So maybe she's leaning a little inside, sacrificing, but probably not because your adrenaline's pumping. You're not even thinking about it. So she's pretty well balanced because what happens right before the gate, and I've watched it 100 times on super slow-mo. Her uphill ski, her right ski catches just before she goes into the air. And that sends her on a trajectory that goes a little bit further to the right. And that's exactly where the gate was. So just that couple inches where her ski grabbed and she moved a couple inches to the right, forced her right hand to get caught around the red pole. Now, everything would have been fine there if she just catches, like her skis weren't caught, it was just her arm. The problem is the gate panels and the flags in downhill and alpine skiing are made of a durable fabric. So when a racer hits them, it doesn't come off because then they'd have to put it on for every racer because often a racer just hits the gate with their shoulder and the flag moves or the wind or whatever and it's Velcroed on. The problem when she caught her arm in the gate and it rode up to the top of the flag. As soon as that arm hit the flag, that's when she started to get twisted around. You can see her arm get pulled back, her right shoulder get pulled back, her right hip gets pulled back, and everything twists to the right like a clock. And once she was in the air, she was cooked. And I said at the time, you could tell her leg was broken, but I can't say that on air. We were live for 20 minutes going through the whole scenario. And you can tell by the screaming that she's broken something, but I can't say it. But because I know when I've seen it 100 times, when you tear your ACL, you hurt your knee, you separate your shoulder, it's an ow, it's an ooh, it's a, couple screams here and there, but not constant screaming like that. Constant screaming like that is a broken bone, femur, tib, fib, whatever, you can tell, but you can't say it when you're on air because then you'd be speculating. But
Yeah.
problem was, she's going sideways through the air on super sharp skis, landing on a flat, and she's not going very fast, so her bindings don't release. And something has to give. She has a knee brace on, a left knee brace, so that's holding her knee in place, and her leg had to give. And it was just tragic to watch, and it was sad to see her get carted away in the helicopter because that's what happened to me. And I had a little bit of a moment there where I was like, oh, yeah, that was me, but she's in good hands, so I wasn't really worried about her. But it was a hard watch and hard for all those people watching who got up early in North America to see her go.
I love the commentary because I feel like we're getting two experts weighing in here. I'm a non-expert, but I totally agree with the two of you. Someone who's 41 and has fought her way to the top of the World Cup standings, and she's earned her way onto the team. It didn't work out, but she's earned everything she's gotten to make that effort. So
And
I'm with the two of you.
she makes ski racing better because everybody talks about her. Everybody knows her. If somebody doesn't, one of my hockey buddies doesn't know alpine skiing up here in Canada, I said, do you know Lindsey Vonn? He goes, yep, I know Lindsey Vonn. And it's good for the sport to have somebody in like that who spreads awareness about what we do and the sport that we love to participate in.
Absolutely. You mentioned hockey a second ago, so I want to come back to that because we, in these games that just finished, I think it's very fair to say that over the years, Canada has had its way with the United States most of the time, in hockey and men's and women's both, and such an important sport in your country. And then here in these games, we had predicted teams in the finals. We had, I would say, unpredictable outcomes. So I know how that washed over in the United States. What was the cut at all this stuff in Canada where hockey is a gigantic sport in the country?
Definitely the number one sport. Everyone watches it. Unfortunately, our dear Toronto Maple Leafs didn't make the playoffs for the first time in 9 years, and the whole city just has a collective sigh at the disappointment. But when Canada's in the gold medal round at the Olympics and it's the last day, and again, Brian talked about the Lindsey Vonn watch parties. Well, there were all these hockey watch parties, and again, I felt the whole country have a collective sigh when we lost both games. But it's just the excitement and the passion that we have, and I'm glad. We got to even it up a little bit and let you guys win. That's fine.
Brian, anything to add there?
I love that the NHL was back at the Olympic Games. I competed in 1998 and we saw Canada lose there as well. But Wayne Gretzky always said that was one of the favorite things he's done in his life was compete in the Olympics there. So it was fun. We had that 2010 win, which was incredible in our home country. I remember that one a lot. Yeah, but it's always a great rivalry. And for the women, they've always had that rivalry. And I've become friends with a lot of the female hockey players just through competing in the Olympics with them. And they're a great bunch of athletes. I've got to practice hockey with them too and shoot on some of their goaltenders. And I can't score, but I'm not that good. But they're pretty
I
incredible.
love it. Well, I
Yeah.
have to share, as a Seattleite, I had the privilege of going up to those 2000 winter games in British Columbia, and distinctly remember sitting in a bar on Robson Street in Vancouver, packed to the gills, and Canada's men's team scores that overtime goal to win the gold. And we as American residents were momentarily crushed, but we love the joy and the passion of all these Canadians who were seeing their team win a gold. And to your earlier comments, Brian, talk about an Olympic Games where I think the sport overall is elevated, and we see how good these men and women are and how much they care, and I think it only ups the ante for hockey going into the future. So I think that's great. And this show isn't about politics anyway, but I've got to ask the two of you. I feel like we've got a bit of an 800-pound gorilla in the room because we've had a leader of our country who's talked about Canada as a 51st state and placed some pretty severe tariffs on, what I would consider one of our country's closest, if not the closest, ally over all the decades. And so it's been a bit of a sore spot and an embarrassment for us in the United States. But I just wonder if the two of you, as proud Canadians, have any comments on what you've seen unfold over the last couple of years to the south of you.
Yeah, I try and pay not too much attention to it. It's a lot of talk, and I'm not that well educated on all of that stuff. But I know from spending time with all the American athletes, they're just the greatest people. We used to spend Christmas together every year in Bormio. We'd race on December 29th in Italy. So we'd race on the 22nd in another race in Italy, and then all travel together and spend Christmas together. So Americans and Canadians always got along well, especially back in the day when not everybody spoke English on the other team. So you saw them as a big rival, but you saw your American friends as allies, and we hope it can continue that way too. Because yeah, we like to get down there and ski with our buddies who we've raced with before, and we've been invited to events down in the States before in Vail, Colorado, and Aspen and Vermont, and just to go skiing with people. So it's always great to get down there and see our friends again.
Yes, it's like ski racing. I'm sure, like many sports, is one big happy family. So we were really good friends with them. We still see them when we go down to Vail. Like everything from Pam Fletcher, Kristen Cooper, Debbie Armstrong, Cindy Nelson. Like there's just all these. Back in the day, the Americans were very strong and very competitive, and we're still friends. That when we see each other, it's like we haven't missed a beat. So it's a great
Bodie
friendship.
Miller, Darren Ralph, Doug Lewis, man, Peekaboo Street. The Americans deliver in the Olympics. They did it again with Breezy Johnson and Ryan Cochran-Segal, whose mom won the Olympic gold in slalom in 1972, and then he won a medal 50 years later in China in Beijing, and then won another medal at these Olympics. So they always know how to deliver big on the big races, and yeah, we're always happy for them.
Well, I love those answers. I love the fact that I think there is this continual bond, no matter the politics. And I one of my loves about the Olympics is you watch these athletes who on competition day are trying to beat each other's brains out. But as you said, Karen, become great friends and great collaborators along with the competition. And you see people talk about it and write about it, and it's what makes the Olympics the spectacle it is, I think. So,
Yeah, if you go on the website, the Londoner Pub, you see how the athletes and the athletes celebrate together, the Americans and the Canadians and Europeans. It's a pretty crazy evening, but that's how we celebrate everybody. In alpine skiing, it's great because you're not really against the other competitor, even though your times are compared. You're against the mountain. So if I'm going to ski down the mountain at my best, I should win. That's how I feel, regardless of what anybody else does. And if somebody else does it better, then he just skied that mountain better. I don't necessarily see it me against him. I see it me against that. How fast can I go down myself? So you do get competitive sometimes, but with some people, but it's just dependent on the individual.
I want to go back to an earlier part of our conversations as we touched on the 26 Winter Games. But Brian, I think you've got a vantage point where you've been in broadcasting, and so you've seen Team Canada through the years. What's the perspective going forward? We always want to look ahead and think about some of those athletes coming up through the ranks and how they're going to do. We've got France coming up in 4 years as the site of the 2030 Winter Games. Do you two have anything you could share on the prospects for Team Canada and maybe some of the names we're gonna hear and remember and some of the stars of tomorrow that you foresee?
Yeah, there's always kids who are coming up and are going to give it a shot. But yeah, our development program hasn't been the greatest because we don't have an endless supply of money to fund those programs. And a lot of our programs have been decimated. We don't have a men's technical team And we don't have a women's speed team for Alpine Canada. So no women downhillers and super G skiers, although they put some GS skiers in those events just because we don't have anybody else. But yeah, there needs to be somebody from some kids from the provinces to get onto the development team, learn how to win on the NORAM circuit. That's a North American Cup circuit, and then move on to World Cup and the Olympics. But it takes time and it takes money. Takes the right direction from the right people. I don't think we've had that in the last little while at Alpine Canada. So they're making some changes, and everybody asked me, who are the up and comers? I'm like, there better be somebody because we're desperately in need of a well-rounded team now. The athletes that are there are, working their tails off to be at their best. But if you don't have a team around you and you're racing just with one or two people, it's easy to be top Canadian. And you want some team competitiveness in there that helps push and pull each other along. And we just don't have that now because they don't have a big enough team like we had back when Karen and I raced.
Anything you want to add to the mix here, Karen?
I don't, Brian does the broadcasting, so he's more in tune with who's up and coming. But I just see my teammate Lisa Savage-Arvey, her daughter Lily Sewell, she's at Montana State and she's trying the whole NCAA circuit. But seeing her come up, she's 22 now, and seeing her coming up through the ranks is so different than when we did it. For instance, when in the 1984 Olympics, Michaela Fagini won the gold medal. She was a Swiss athlete, and she was 17 years old. And so
Wow.
it's really changed. And Lily's toughing it out on that NCAA circuit, raced some North American races this year, and it's just tough to break through for the kids. It costs a lot of money. She's very thankful she got a scholarship. But yeah, it seems to me when I look at these kids up and coming now, it just seems a little bit more difficult, costs more money. Back in the day, leading up to the 88 Olympics in our home country in Calgary, we were both benefiting from that time because there was a lot of influx of money from corporate sponsors, from the private sector, from it just seemed like, because of the focus leading up to the games, everything was free. I mean, we didn't have to pay for anything when we were on the team. And now a lot of these athletes are out there GoFundMe and trying to raise money, and it's just seems more difficult.
It's tough, but we'll watch for Lily Sewell. We'll put
Yeah.
that name in the back of our heads.
Yeah, it's a great pathway, the American college and university program, the NCAA program. It's a great pathway for Canadians to go and pursue a ski racing career and have an education after, because I'm not sure what I would have done because I didn't finish high school. So it's hard for kids out there who put everything on hold. And if they don't make it, then what if they don't have an education? So that's where I see some lacking here in Canada, where kids would rather go to the States and do that than get the programs here because the programs here aren't as beneficial as they can be down there.
It's interesting. One of you mentioned money a second ago, and I want to come to that point with the Olympic Games because I feel like we've seen a bit of a tectonic shift over the years. And you two having been in prior games, I want to hear your take on it. But I think Milan Cortina was another example of an Olympic Games based a lot on the economics of how to put on a games versus the fan convenience of how to watch a game. We had Milan staging some, and then, across the Alps, several hours, you'd have other events. If you're a fan, you had to make some tough choices about what you could and couldn't watch. And everything I understand is that France will be very similar in 2030. 2010 in Vancouver and Whistler might even have started that tradition with separating out parts of the games. What do you two think about that? If you're a fan, it's probably more convenient to go to the Olympic Games of your days than it is to go to the modern day Olympics. But it's the economics of the sport dictating a lot of what, where these games are held. Any thoughts on that? Do you have any thumbs up, thumbs down observations about all of that?
I'm not sure as a fan. Well, I guess I was a fan in 2010. I was also in Vancouver watching those Olympics. And we did have to take some buses up to Whistler and things, so we traveled a bit. I'm really sad for the athletes because in 1984 in Sarajevo, we were in the Olympic Village. There were two buildings. We got to know everybody from speed skaters, country skiers to the. They apparently tried to keep the hockey players away from us. The bobsledders. In fact, there was a marriage between Lori Graham, who was my teammate, and bobsledder Clark Flynn, and they met at the Olympics. So I really enjoyed getting to, I got to know the Japanese bobsled team. And so to be in a village with all these athletes, it was just electric and wonderful to meet everyone. So I always felt a bit sad hearing that some of the athletes, were isolated and maybe didn't experience that.
Yeah, that's how it was for us in 1992 in Albertville. We were up in Val d'Isère, which is 2.5 hours from Albertville on a tiny dirt road and hard to get to. And it just seemed like another World Cup race for us. We were all staying at one hotel. And I think that was the same this year in Bormio, a little difficult to get to. And they were all, well, they were staying in three different hotels, but it didn't really feel like the Olympic Games for them. And I'm certain that's how it's going to be in France in 2030. It's going to be the same deal. It's just too hard to have all those venues close together when there's so many different sports and so many different things to watch. Before it was just figure skating and hockey and downhill skiing, and that's it. And you're 3 hours of television and off you go. You can get back to what you like. But now it's on 24/7 with all these different sports and the ski-mo and like, come on, really? Like, let's go here.
I also I feel sad for the people that get to do the opening ceremonies. Again, opening ceremonies in Sarajevo, Gaëtan Boucher, speed skater, carrying the flag. The entire team walked in together, and just being on the bus with them and talking to them, it's just a wonderful moment. It's if you talk to even the NHL hockey players will say, those are one of their favorite moments being in the Olympics. So yeah, I find it very strange that it's also.
Yeah, I joined the two of you in being a little sad and wistful, wishing for some of those past kinds of locations. I wrote in my book about Squaw Valley 1916. It was all very contained in a small area, and so all the athletes got to know each other. So easy for the spectators to witness all the sports. Times have changed, and some of it we like, some of it we don't, but I guess it's part of progress and modern day versus back in the day.
Yeah, I've only been to I've been to four Olympics and only been to one opening ceremonies because the downhill is generally the next day or shortly after, and that was in Calgary where we decided to go right after our training run. Our coaches told us not to go, and we kind of gave them the finger and said, "See you later."
Love it.
Fortunately, the race was canceled or postponed the next day because of high winds. So we got a day of reprieve, and the coaches weren't too angry at us.
That's one of my favorite photos of you walking in
Yeah, it
Calgary.
was the best. I say that's the best Olympic moment of my career is walking into the opening ceremony. So if I didn't have that, I'm not sure what I'd have afterwards.
Hey, I want to wrap up with something a little more on the light side. I'm always amazed at how many people in the United States don't know a lot about Canada and what it has to offer. And you, of course, have so many great cities and natural landscapes, but I'm going to turn you two into tour guides for a moment. And for people listening, if you had to say in Canada, you should not go your lifetime without seeing these spots. For the two of you, do you have a don't miss one and two or one and two and three for the country you've called home all these years?
Yes, definitely. I just hearing the question got me excited. I would say to anyone that wants to come, first of all, you're winning on your dollar because when we like you're going to come up here and find everything so cheap. What are we, 72 cents on the dollar? So I love the East Coast and I love the West for, of course, Toronto. It's a big city. If you like the city, there's shows and all these things you can do here. But the East Coast, there's a wonderful little island called Prince Edward Island, and our dear friend LPGA. Bay golfer Lori Kane lives there, and they have just a beautiful beaches and seafood in the summer. Our parents went to Newfoundland, which is the bigger island, even further east, and very famous for a couple of things. When 9/11 hit, all of the planes descended upon Gander, Newfoundland. And so there was a Broadway show called Come From Away, all about Newfoundland. And it's just beautiful with parks, and you can go there and see the icebergs coming. So that's the East Coast. My daughter goes to school in Halifax, Nova Scotia, also East Coast, amazing. Then the West. So I was just in Lake Louise doing a corporate ski event, and the Rocky Mountains and being in Banff and Lake Louise is just stunning. I've been there many times. I was just there a few weeks ago, and it never gets old. It's just gorgeous. So those would be my two favorite.
Yeah, same with me. The people on the East Coast are just the nicest people in the world. They're kind, polite, generous. They'll give you the shirt off their back, and yeah, they're just the greatest people, respectful and all that stuff. The West Coast is beautiful. Vancouver and Whistler. Well, you said you were there on Robson Street. I was probably in a bar just down from you, or that was right after. After I finished up in Whistler doing all the ski events there, the gold medal that Lindsey Vonn won there in 2010 was thrilling too. So I got to call that one and be there for that. But really anywhere you go, even if you go to Winnipeg or Saskatoon and Saskatchewan, like there's things to offer. The north here, the lakes and just beautiful countryside and quiet, serene place you can go canoeing. Stuff like that.
Our
There's
parents went
a bit of
polar bear
everything.
watching in the north.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
And it's not as cold as you think. So you can come to Toronto and play a lot of nice golf courses too. Yeah, we have it pretty good up here.
beautiful country. I have Banff on my short list and my bucket list both. So I love that one being called out. So I want to thank the two of you. That's going to be a wrap, and so appreciate both of you coming into our living rooms. And I want to invite everybody back for our podcast number 7 next month. We're going to recast our glances at the 2028 LA Games that are coming in just a couple short years. Again, Brian and Karen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. It's been great chatting with you.
Thanks very much. Come to Canada. Come visit.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history. But as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even write an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.